passwords. More than 17,000 of those chose the password 123456, and close to 4,600 chose the word password as their password. Common User Password Profiler, CUPP, is a tool that was created to make password profiling an easy task. Mergus Kurgan, also known as Jorgen, created this amazing little tool. It runs as a script in the leading penetration testing distribution, Backtrack. The most common form of authentication is the combination of a username and a password or passphrase. If both match values stored within a locally stored table, the user is authenticated for connection. Password strength is a measure of the difficulty involved in guessing or breaking the password through cryptographic techniques or library-based automated testing of alternative values. A weak password might be very short or only use alphanumeric characters, making decryption simple. A weak password is also one that can be easily guessed by someone profiling the user, such as a birthday, nickname, address, name of a pet or relative, or a common word such as God, love, money, or password. Because most users have weak passwords that can be easy to guess, CUPP is a perfect tool for profiling. It can be used for legal penetration tests or forensic crime investigations. The power of this type of tool is that it can take a lot of the guesswork out of the password guessing aspect of social engineering. CEWL. As described by its authors, CEWL is a Ruby application that spiders a given URL to a specified depth, optionally following external links, and returns a list of words that can be used for password crackers, such as John the Ripper. For more information about CEWL, see their website at www.digininja.org. Using CEWL against a target company, in a session, generated 430 potential passwords to try from just one page of their web presence. CUPP and CEWL are just two tools at your disposal to help profile and generate a list of potential passwords. An interesting exercise is to run one of these tools using your own information and see if any passwords you use are on the lists it generated. It can be very sobering and make you want to take password security very seriously. Summary. Tools are an important aspect of social engineering, but they do not make the social engineer. A tool alone is useless, but the knowledge of how to leverage and utilize that tool is invaluable. If one overwhelming theme in this chapter resounds, it is that practice makes perfect. Whether you are using the phone, software-based tools, the web, or other spy gadgets, practicing how to utilize them is essential to success. For example, when using the phone for social engineering, you can use spoofing technologies or even voice-changing technologies. And while having all this great technology is amazing, you can make a call and sound too scripted, nervous and jittery, or unprepared and unknowledgeable, then all hope for social engineering success is lost, and most likely any credibility too. This principle goes back to being very well versed in pretexting. How would the person you are trying to impersonate talk? What would he say? How would he say it? What knowledge would he possess? What information would he ask for? Whether the social engineer uses a software tool, hardware tool, or both, taking the time to learn the ins and outs of each tool and each feature can make or break the success of the audit. Tools can take substantial time off audits, and they can also fill in any deficiency gaps an auditor may have. This dynamic becomes apparent as you analyze the case studies in Chapter 8. Chapter 8. Case Studies. Dissecting the Social Engineer. The best security is through education. Maddie Aroney. Throughout this book, I go through each aspect of what makes a great social engineer, Putting the information in these pages into play can make a social engineer a force to be reckoned with. In school, students review history to learn what should and should not be done. History is a great tool for educating us about what things have worked in the past and why. It can tell us where we are going and how we can get there. Social engineering history is not so different. Throughout the history of business, people have been there to scam and steal. People have devoted their lives to helping secure against those bad forces. Discussing the aspects of professional social engineer attacks is often difficult because they were either done illegally or cannot be openly discussed due to client contracts. Fortunately, Kevin Mitnick, world-famous social engineer and computer security expert, has published many of his stories for our reading pleasure. I have taken some of these stories from his book, The Art of Deception. In this chapter, I pick two of Mitnick's most famous stories from his books and give a brief recap of what Kevin did, analyzing what aspects of social engineering he used and discussing what everyone can learn from it. After dissecting those two accounts, I do the same with two of my own accounts that demonstrate the ease with which you can obtain information and how easily you can use the information to compromise an entire company. Finally, I will disclose two top secret stories whose sources I can't even mention. But, as you will see, you will learn a lot from these accounts. What I am aiming to accomplish is to show you how dangerous even little bits of information can be, and how devastating they can be in the hands of a skilled social engineer. At the same time, you will see where a social engineer can learn from past successes and failures to enhance their own skill set. Let's get started with the first case study. Mitnick Case Study 1. Hacking the DMV. Kevin Mitnick is widely known as one of the world's most notorious social engineers. He has performed some of the boldest and most famous exploits in the world, and the exploit examined here is especially so. A driver's license can often come in handy for obtaining information on people. Having the target's driver's license number can allow a social engineer to gain all sorts of personal information. However, no free services exist that allow a person to gain access to this personal information. A social engineer or private investigator must go through some lengths to be able to obtain and then use this information on a target. Kevin Mitnick, in his book, The Art of Deception, has a story he called The Reverse Sting. The following sections provide some background information and analysis of this account. The target. In one of Mitnick's greatest stories, he discusses how Eric wanted to use the non-public Department of Motor Vehicles, or DMV, and police systems to obtain people's driver's license numbers. He regularly needed to obtain license information on targets. Eric had a method of obtaining this information, but feared repeated social engineering calls would render the DMV useless or alert police to his ways. He needed a different method to access the DMV's network. And with some knowledge of how the DMV works, he knew just how to do it. His target was twofold, not only the DMV, but also the police who would assist him, of course without knowing it, in accomplishing his goal of obtaining this information. The story. Eric knew that the DMV could give privileged information to insurance agencies, private investigators, and certain other groups. Each industry had access to only certain types of data. An insurance company is privy to different information than a PI, whereas a law enforcement agent can get it all. Eric's goal was to get all the information. Obtaining an unpublished DMV phone number. Eric took a few steps that really proved his excellent social engineering skills. First, he called telephone information and asked for the phone number for DMV headquarters. Of course, the number he was given was for the public, and what he wanted was something that would get him deeper. He then called the local sheriff's office and asked for teletype, which is the office where communications are sent to and received by other law enforcement agencies. When he reached the teletype department, he asked the person for the number that law enforcement would use when calling the DMV headquarters. Now, I don't know about you, but that seems like it would fail. It just about did. "Who are you?" he was asked. He had to think quickly and responded, "This is Al. I was calling 503-555-5753. All he did was give a random number with the same area code and base number and made up the last four digits. Then he just shut up. The officer made some assumptions. He was internal and already had the number for a non-public area, teletype. He had almost all the number for the DMV. With those two facts firmly in the officer's mind, he assumed that Eric was allowed in and gave him the number. Eric wanted more than one number, though. He wanted as many as he could get his hands on. Accomplishing this goal would require an even deeper hack, a multi-level, multifaceted attack with many different avenues. It would be of epic proportion. Gaining access to the state's phone system. Eric called the number he was given to get into the DMV. He told the DMV representative he was from Nortel and needed to speak to a technician because he worked with the DMS-100, a much-used switch. When he was on with a technician, he claimed to be with the Texas Nortel Technical Assistance Center and explained he was updating all switches. It would be done remotely, and the technician wouldn't need to do anything except provide the dial-in number to the switch so that Eric could perform the updates directly from the Technical Assistance Center. This story sounded completely believable, so the technician complied, giving Eric all the info he requested. Armed with this information, he could now dial directly into one of the state's telephone switches. Getting a password. The next hurdle was one that could have stopped the whole hack dead in its tracks. Getting passwords. The Nortel switches that the DMV used were password protected. From past experience in using Nortel switches, Eric knew that Nortel uses a default user account, NTAS. Eric then dialed in several times trying the standard passwords he has encountered. NTAS, fail. Account name, fail. Helper, fail. Patch, fail. Update, success. Wow, really? The password was update? He now had full control over the switch and all lines connected to it. He queried the telephone lines that were his target. He quickly found out that 19 phone lines went to the same department. After checking some of the internal setup of the switch, he found out that the switch was programmed to hunt through the 19 lines until it found one that was not busy. He picked line 18 and entered the standard forwarding code that added a call forwarding command to that phone line. Eric bought a cheap, prepaid cell phone that could be disposed of easily. He entered that number as the number to forward to when line 18 was rung. Basically, as soon as the DMV got busy enough to have people on 17 lines, the 18th call would not ring to the DMV, but to Eric's cell phone. It wasn't too long until that started happening. Around 8 a.m. the next morning, the cell phone started to ring. Each time, it was a police officer looking for information on a person of interest. He would field calls from police at his house, at lunch, in the car. No matter where it was, he pretended to be the DMV representative. What made me personally get a good laugh was how the calls are reported as going, the cell phone would ring and Eric would say, "DMV, may I help you?" "This is Detective Andrew Cole." "Hi, Detective. What can I do for you today?" "I need a Soundex on driver's license 00560-2789. "Sure, let me bring up the record." While he simulated working on a computer, he asked a couple of questions. "Detective Cole, what is your agency?" "Jefferson County." Eric would then launch the following questions. "What is your requester code?" "What is your driver's license number?" "What is your date of birth?" As the officer would give all his personal information, Eric would pretend to be verifying it all. Then he would feign confirmation and ask what details he needed on his call. He would pretend to look up the name and other information, then say, "My computer just went down again. Sorry, detective, my computer has been on the blink all week. Would you mind calling back and getting another clerk to help you?" This would be a little irritating, I'm sure, for the officer, but it would tie up all the loose ends. In the meantime, Eric now owned the identity of that officer. He could use this information for many things, but mostly to obtain information from the DMV whenever he needed. He did his DMV information gathering for a few hours, then called back into the switch and disabled call forwarding. He now had a juicy list of information in his possession. For months after his hack, Eric could easily dial back in, enable the call forwarding switch, collect a number of officers' information facts, disable call forwarding, and then use those police credentials to obtain valid driver's licenses that he would sell to private investigators or others who would not ask how he obtained this information. Applying the SE framework to the DMV hack. In this story, Kevin identified some things that Eric did and attitudes he had that made him successful, such as not being afraid or uncomfortable talking to police and being able to find his way around unfamiliar areas. You can also identify what part of the social engineering framework Eric used and how he used it. For example, the first step in any successful social engineering audit or attack is information gathering. In this account, you can see that Eric must have really done his homework prior to the attack. He knew a lot about the phone system, the way the DMV operates, and the general workings of the process he wanted to infiltrate. I am not sure how long ago this attack occurred, but nowadays, making an attack like it is even easier due to the internet. It is a gold mine for information gathering. Just a couple of years ago, someone figured out a hack for a Tranax ATM, and within a few weeks, manuals containing step-by-step processes of how to perform the hack were available on the internet. Also, as mentioned previously in this book, choosing a pretext that mimics what you do in real life or things you did in the past can increase your chance for success. The power lies in the fact that because the pretext is more realistic to you, it helps you gather information as well as breach the target. Eric seemed to have a very intimate knowledge of this field. As you may recall, the next part of the framework, the elicitation, or being able to cleverly craft questions to obtain information or access to something you want. Eric elicited information masterfully. When on the phone with the police, Eric's use of elicitation served as the proof that he was who he said he was and knew his job well. He knew the lingo and asked routine questions that had to be answered. As a matter of fact, not asking those questions would probably have caused more of an alarm than by asking them. That is the power of good elicitation tactics. Early on, Eric knew he had to obtain certain phone numbers to perform the attack. Instead of trying to explain why he needed certain information, he used an assumptive close, as mentioned in Chapter 3, and asked questions that basically stated, "I deserve these answers now, so tell me what I'm asking." This is another example of powerful elicitation. You can learn a lot from analyzing these methods closely. Most good attacks also include a very high amount of pretexting. This account was no exception. Eric had to develop a few pretexts in this attack vector. He had to switch gears many times to accomplish his goals. As impressive as it is that Eric had to impersonate law enforcement, which he did very well, keep in mind that this practice is highly illegal in the United States. You can learn much from the process and methods Eric used, but be cautious how you apply them. Even in a paid social engineering audit, impersonating a law enforcement agent is illegal. Know your local laws. That is the lesson. Or don't be afraid to be caught. Despite the fact that it is illegal, you can learn a lot from analyzing Eric's attitude in this hack. He was always collected. When he put on the pretext of the DMV agent, he was able to use elicitation that served as the proof. When he put on the police pretext, his demeanor, voice, and phrases all backed up the pretext. Switching gears can be hard for many people, so it is best to practice before you go live with this. Eric's pretexts were solid, and he did a masterful job at holding them together, especially when he had to act as a DMV agent and field real calls from police. In many circumstances, he could have easily fallen out of character, but he seemed to hold it together quite well. Many of the techniques used for psychological aspects of social engineering, such as IQs and microexpressions, were not used in this attack, because it happened mostly over the phone. Eric did have to utilize certain aspects of the framework, though, such as rapport building, NLP, and modes of thinking. Eric seemed to be a natural at building rapport. He was personable and easygoing, and seemed to not be afraid of the what-ifs, and was able to be and act confident in his abilities. He posed his voice and his conversation in a way that gave the person on the other end of the phone all the reason to trust him and no reason not to believe him. Eric used impressive interrogation and interview tactics, even using them on law enforcement agents who are experienced in interview tactics. He used those tactics so successfully that he was undetected in his methods and obtained all the information he wanted. Eric also seemed to have an excellent grasp of and ability to use influencing tactics. Probably one of the most noticeable in the attack was when he asked the police officer to call back to get a different DMV agent. This was probably annoying for the officer, but what made the tactic successful is that Eric gave the officer something first. That is, he verified the data the officer needed, and when he was supposed to give the official final piece of info is when the computer froze. Applying some rules of influence, Eric was easily able to get the officers to comply. Closely linked to Eric's pretext was his ability to use framing successfully. To refresh your memory, framing is bringing the target in line with your thinking by positioning yourself and your stories to make them believable. It is an important piece of the pretext puzzle, and makes you stand out and prove to the target you certainly are who you say you are. Eric's pretexts were great and believable, but what really sold them were the frames that he used. His frame changed depending on who he was talking to. At one point, he had to make sure the officer on the other end would give him the teletype number. On the other call, he had to be a knowledgeable and skilled DMV agent. Eric made himself believable using framing by assuming he would get the information he asked, showing no fear in his dwellings and confidently asking for information he felt he was owed. All these attitudes framed the target to accept his pretext and allow for natural responses. As you can see, you can learn much by analyzing Eric's social engineer attack. One can only assume that Eric either had practiced all these methods or had a few dry runs to know all he did about the internal systems used in the attack. Eric's methods worked out for him and were successful, but I would have taken a couple of extra precautions. For example, when he was fielding DMV calls, I would have made sure I forwarded the number only when I was in the office. I would have set up an office area with some background office noises and the proper supplies to take down all the information I needed to avoid the risk of a waitress or friend blowing my cover. Although a disposable cell phone is a good idea for tracing purposes, another technique is to have that number forwarded to a Google Voice or Skype number. I tend not to trust cell signals, and nothing could have ruined the gig faster than having the call drop or having a weak static-filled signal. Besides these items, one can't improve much in this hack. Eric did a superb job and making sure it was done right by using many of the talents and skills in the framework to accomplish his goal. Mitnick Case Study 2: Hacking the Social Security Administration. Mitnick mentions a man he called Keith Carter, a less than honorable private investigator hired to do some digging into a man who was hiding funds from his soon-to-be estranged wife. She had funded his venture, which had grown into a multi-million dollar company. The divorce was almost settled, but the woman's attorneys needed to find the hidden assets. This attack vector is interesting because, as in the first case study, the story follows a very shady method of gathering intelligence. The target. The target was to find the assets of the husband, Joe Johnson. But that wasn't the target for the actual social engineering attack. To obtain information on Joe, the private investigator, Keith, had to hack the Social Security Administration. Many times in a social engineering audit, this option will present itself. This section covers some of the methods he used to accomplish this goal. But suffice it to say that hacking the SSA is a very slippery slope. As the story unfolds, you will see how dangerous this particular hack was. The story. Joe Johnson was married to a very wealthy woman. He had knowingly used tens of thousands of her dollars to invest in one of his ideas. That idea grew into a multi-million dollar organization. As things happen, their marriage was not too solid, so they decided to divorce. During the divorce proceedings, soon-to-be ex-Mrs. Johnson knew he was hiding his money, trying to keep it out of the divorce settlement. She hired Keith, the private investigator who was a less-than-ethical guy, who didn't mind riding the edge of what was legal and what was not to obtain the information he needed to make the case. As Keith sat down to analyze the case, he determined that a good starting point was the Social Security Administration. He thought that if he could just obtain Joe's records, he would be able to find some discrepancies and then nail his coffin shut. He wanted to be able to freely call Joe's banks, investment firms, and offshore accounts, pretexting as Joe. To do so, he needed some detailed information, which is what led him to the path of hacking the Social Security office. Keith began with basic information gathering. He went online and found a guide describing the SSA's internal systems and their internal terminology and jargon. After studying that and having the jargon down pat, he called the local public number of the Social Security office. When he got a live person, he asked to be connected to the claims office. The conversation went like this. Hi, this is Gregory Adams, District Office 329. Listen, I'm trying to reach a claims adjuster who handles an account number that ends in 6363, and the number I have goes to a fax machine. Oh, that is Mod 3. The number is... Really? That easy? Wow. In a few moments' time, he gets the number of the internal office phones that the public normally cannot get. Now comes the hard part. He has to call Mod 3, change his pretext, and obtain useful information on Joe. Thursday morning comes around, and it looks like Keith has his plan well laid out. He picks up the phone and dials the Mod 3 number. Mod 3, this is Mei Lin Huang. Miss Huang, this is Arthur Arendelle in the office of the Inspector General. Can I call you Mei? It's Mei Lin, she says. Well, it's like this, Mei Lin. We have a new guy who doesn't have a computer yet, and right now he has a priority project to do and he is using mine. We're the government of the United States, for crying out loud, and they say they don't have enough money in the budget to buy a computer for this guy to use. And now my boss thinks I'm falling behind and doesn't want to hear any excuses, you know. I know what you mean, all right. Can you help me with a quick inquiry on MCS? He asked, using the name of the computer system for looking up taxpayer information. Sure, what do you need? The first thing I need you to do is an alpha dent on Joseph Johnson, DOB 7469. Alpha dent means to have the computer search for an account alphabetically by taxpayer name, further identified by date of birth. What do you need to know? What's his account number? Keith asks. This is Joe's Social Security number he's asking for. She read it off. Okay, I need you to do a numadent on that account number. Numadent is similar to alphadent, only it's a numerical search instead of an alphabetical one. This was a request for her to read off the basic taxpayer data, and Mei Lin responded by giving the taxpayer's place of birth, mother's maiden name, and father's name, Keith listened patiently while she also gave him the month and year Joe's Social Security number was issued, and the district office it was issued by. Keith next asked for a DEQI. It's short for Detailed Earnings Query. For what year? Year 2001. Maylin said, the amount was $190,286, and the payer was Johnson Microtech. Any other wages? No. Thanks, Keith said. You've been very kind. Keith then tried to arrange to call her whenever he needed information and couldn't get on his computer, using a favorite trick of social engineers of always trying to establish a connection so that he can keep going back to the same person, avoiding the nuisance of having to find a new mark each time. Not next week, she told him, because she was going to Kentucky for her sister's wedding. Any other time, she'd do whatever she could. At this point, it seemed like game over. Keith had all the information he set out to obtain, and now it was just a matter of calling the banks and offshore accounts, which, armed with the information he had now become a much easier task. A well-executed and truly awe-inspiring attack. Applying the SE framework to the SSA hack. The SSA attack, just described, leaves your mouth ajar and wide open. You can learn much from this particular attack, which used the social engineering framework. Keith started the attack with information gathering. You are probably really tired of hearing me say this over and over again, but having information is truly the crux of every good social engineer attack. The more you have, the better. Keith first found a truly amazing piece of intel on the web, which dumbfoundingly enough is still online at secure.ssa.gov. There you can find an online manual for program operations of the Social Security Administration, as well as what SSA employees are allowed to tell law enforcement. Armed with this information, Keith knew what to ask, how to ask, and how to sound like he belonged, as well as what information would raise red flags. Although the link provided a wealth of information, he decided to take his information gathering a step further using a pretext of an Inspector General Office employee and calling his local SSA office. He really thought outside the box by using his local office to obtain the internal numbers he needed to complete his pretext as an internal employee. Keith switched pretexts a couple of times and did so masterfully. He was able to obtain much of the information he needed using the online SSA manual to develop the right questions. This manual proved to be an elicitation developer's dream. Armed with the right words and language, he sounded like he fit right in. He built rapport and a frame that fed the pretext perfectly. Building rapport is not an easy task, but Keith did it well in a way that indicated he was well practiced in this technique. He used many influence tactics to make sure the target felt comfortable and at ease. For example, he mixed obligation and reciprocation artfully when he was able to get Maylin on his side by describing the lack of good tools and the lack of support from his management. She felt obligated to help him out. He also used key words and phrases that commanded empathy and yet showed his authority, such as, "My boss is not happy with me," which gives an indication that he is in trouble and that the SSA employee, Maylin, can save him. People have a moral obligation to save those in need. Not many can walk away when someone is asking for help, and Maylin couldn't either. She felt compelled to not only help, but to even tell Keith about her personal schedule. In the end, Keith used a number of important skills in the framework that do not involve personal on-site in-person action. The fact that governmental systems are run by people make them fallible to the hacking methods used in this story. This is not an argument for the invention of robotic or computerized systems to do these jobs. It merely points to the fact that many of these systems rely so much on overworked, underpaid, overstressed people that manipulating them is not a very hard job. To be honest, improving upon this particular attack is difficult because it is not one I would ever perform myself, and Keith did a superb job of applying the principles of the framework. So many people are used to being mistreated, abused, and yelled at that a little bit of kindness can make them go to extraordinary heights to help out. This particular attack, as relayed in Mitnick's The Art of Deception, shows how vulnerable systems that rely on people truly are. Hadnagy Case Study 1. The Overconfident CEO. My experience with an overconfident CEO is interesting because the CEO thought he would be impervious to any social engineering attempt for two reasons. First, he did not utilize technology much in his personal life. And second, he felt that he was too smart and protected to fall for what he calls silly games. With that being said, to his internal security team, they decided to ask me to focus on him as the goal of the audit. They knew that if he did fail the audit, it would be easier to get approval to implement many of the fixes that would help their security. The target. The target was a decent-sized printing company in the U.S. that had some proprietary processes and vendors that some of its competitors were after. The IT and security teams realized that the company had some weaknesses and convinced the CEO an audit was needed. In a phone meeting with my partner, the CEO arrogantly said that he knew that hacking him would be next to impossible because he guarded these secrets with his life. Not even some of his core staff knew all the details. My job as the SE auditor was to infiltrate the company to obtain access to one of the company's servers where this proprietary information was held and retrieve it. The difficulty, as the CEO had mentioned on the phone, was that the passwords for the servers were stored on his computer and no one had access to it, not even the security staff, without his permission. The story. Apparently, the way in would have to involve the CEO, which presented a challenge because he was ready and waiting for an infiltration attempt. I started off, as I did with any gig, by information gathering. I researched the company using online resources and other tools such as Multigo. I was able to harvest information such as locations of servers, IP addresses, email addresses, phone numbers, physical addresses, mail servers, employee names and titles, and much more. Of course, I documented all this information in a fashion that made it easy to use later on. The structure of the email was important, because as I searched the website, I saw that it was firstname.lastname@company.com. I could not locate the CEO's email address, but many articles listed his name. Let's call him Charles Jones, and title on their site. This would be information a standard, non-informed attacker would be able to obtain. Using the firstname.lastname@company.com format, I tried to send an email to him. It didn't work. I was actually disappointed at this moment because I was sure that the email method would yield a lot of juicy details. I decided to try a nickname for Charles, so I tried chuck.jones@company.com. Sweet success, I had a verified email address. Now I just had to verify it was the CEO's and not some other guy with the same name. I spent some more time on Google and MaltEgo to harvest as much information as I could. MaltEgo has this great transform that allows me to search a domain for any files that would be visible to a normal search engine. I ran the transform against the company's domain and was greeted with an amazing number of files for my browsing. MaltEgo doesn't stop with just providing file names with this transform. Many files contain metadata, which is the information about the dates, creators, and other juicy little tidbits about the file. Running MaltEgo's metadata transform showed me that the majority of these files were created by a Chuck Jones. Much of the content in the files talked about him as the CEO. This was the confirmation I needed, but during my browse, one file had caught my eye. InvoiceApril.xls. Upon reading that file, I discovered it was an invoice from a local bank for a marketing venture Chuck was involved in. I had the bank name, the date, and the amount, but I didn't have the event the company was a part of. I did a quick search of the bank website, but because the event was 6 months earlier, it was not listed on the site. What could I do? I decided to place a call to the marketing person from the bank. Hi, this is Tom from company name. I'm trying to organize our books, and I see an invoice here from April for $3,500 as a sponsorship package, but I don't see the event name. Can you please tell me what that invoice was for? Sure, Tom, she said, and I heard some clicking noise in the background. I see that was the bank's annual Children's Cancer Fund drive. And you were a part of the silver package. Thanks a lot. I'm new here and I appreciate your help. Talk with you later. I was beginning to see a picture of a possible attack vector that I could use, but I needed some more research and needed to make a very carefully planned phone call. I found a few articles on the web about this fundraiser and how many companies came from all over the community to support it with money for cancer treatment research. In addition, the more digging I did into the CEO, the more I found out about him. I had his parents' names, his sister's names, pictures of his kids that he has on Facebook, the church he went to when he lived near his parents, a review he wrote of his favorite restaurant, his favorite sporting team, his oldest son's favorite sporting team, and where he attended college, where his kids go to school, and the list goes on and on. I wanted to find out why the company donates to the Children's Cancer Fund. Although many malicious social engineers exploit others' emotions, and I realized I might have to go down this path as well, I wanted to know whether the fund was something he was involved in because one of his sons has cancer. I placed a call to the marketing director of the company. Hello, this is Tom from XYZ. I was hired by First National Bank in town to call those who took part in the April Children's Cancer Fund, and I was wondering whether I could take a few minutes of your time to get some feedback. Sure, Sue, the marketing director said. Sue, I see you were part of our silver package in April. Did you feel the marketing you received was worth the price you paid? Well, this is something we do every year, and it does get us a lot of press time in the local area. I guess I wouldn't mind seeing a little more on the website for the silver package. Excellent. I will note that. Every year? Yes, I see you do this every year. I'm wondering personally, with so many fundraisers out there, why do you choose this one? I know Chuck has always been particular to this one. He is our CEO, and I think someone in his family battled cancer. Oh my, I'm sorry to hear that. It isn't his own children, is it? No, I think a nephew or cousin. We didn't really talk about it. Well, we certainly appreciate your donation and support. I finished up with a few more questions and then left it at that, thanking her for her time, and we parted ways. I got the information I needed. It wasn't one of his kids who had cancer. Again, I knew this wouldn't stop a malicious social engineer, but I was very curious. Armed with this information, I was ready to plan my attack vector. I knew the CEO was originally from New York and his favorite restaurant was a place called Domingo's. He would bring his kids in often for a Mets game and then they would go eat at Domingo's. He wrote some ratings on the place and talked about his top three favorite dishes. I knew his parents still lived close by and he visited often from some other things he wrote on Facebook. I planned my attack vector to be a fundraiser for cancer research. It was for the tri-state area, and for a small donation, one's name would be entered into a raffle. The raffle prize would be two tickets to a Mets game, and a choice of three restaurant coupons, one of which was Domingo's. I would pretend to be from New York myself, but relatively new in case he threw things at me I didn't know. My end goal would be for him to accept a PDF from me that would be maliciously encoded to give me a reverse shell and allow me access to his computer. If he did not use a version of Adobe that would allow me access, then I would try to convince him to download a zip file and execute an enclosed EXE that would have the malicious file embedded. I practiced the phone conversation I would use for my pretext. I tested my PDF and EXE files, and I had Google Maps open to the location of Domingo's, so I could talk about that area openly. After I had my computer ready and waiting to receive the malicious payload from the victim, I was ready to place the call. I placed the call around 4 p.m., because I found out through the company website that the office closes at 4:30 on Fridays. Because I wasn't on the initial meeting phone call to set up this audit, my partner was, The CEO would not recognize my voice. Hello, is Mr. Charles Jones available? Sure, one second. The voice on the other end sounded tired and was ready to transfer me. Hello, Chuck speaking. Hello, Mr. Jones. My name is Tony from the Cancer Research Institute of America. We are running an annual fund drive to support our research into cancer that plagues men, women, and children. Please call me Chuck, he interrupted. This was a good sign because he didn't give me any excuses or try to end the phone call saying he was busy. He took it upon himself to personalize the conversation. I continued, Chuck, thank you. We are running a fund drive for companies who supported cancer funds before and are asking for small donations of $50 to $150. The great part is that everyone who helps us out is being entered into a drawing for two great prizes. If you win, you get two tickets to a Mets game in New York City and then a free dinner for two at one of three great restaurants. We are giving out five of those packages. Mets game? Really? I know, if you don't like the Mets, the prize might not appeal to you, but the restaurants are good. No, I love the Mets. That's why I said that. I was happy. Well, think about this. Not only are you helping out a great research fund, but you get a good game in. And you could go eat at Morton's, Basil's, or Domingo's. Domingo's? Really? I love that place. That is great. You know, I just went there the other night for the first time and had their chicken portabella. It was awesome. This was his third favorite dish. Oh, if you think that is good, forget it. You need to try the Fra Diablo. It is really the best dish in there. I eat it all the time. I'm going to go there again over the weekend. I'll definitely try that out. Thanks for the tip. Look, I know it's getting late. Right now, I'm not even looking for money. I don't want to take money over the phone. What I can do is send you the PDF. You can look at it, and if you're interested, you can just mail the check-in with the form. Heck yeah, send it over. Okay, just a couple of questions. What is your email? chuck.jones@company.com. If you can, open your PDF reader, click the Help menu, and About, and tell me the version number, please. 1 minute. It's 8.04. Excellent. I don't want to send you a version that you can't use. Just 1 second while we're on the phone. I'm going to send this to you, okay? Okay, it's sent. Great, thanks. I hope I win. I really love that place. I know, the food is good. Before I let you go, could you just check to see whether you got the email and let me know if it's working? Sure, I'm logging out in about 5 minutes, but I can check. Yep, it is here. When I heard the sound of double-clicking, I looked over on my backtrack computer, saw my malicious payload collector, Meterpreter, reacting. I was holding my breath, because this part never gets boring. And, bam, the shell appeared. My Meterpreter scripts changed the ownership to something like explorer.exe. Chuck then said, all I got is a blank screen. It's not doing anything. Really? That's odd. Let me check here. What I was really checking was that I had access to his drive and the ability to upload a reverse shell that would run on reboot in case he shut down. I said, I'm sorry. I don't know what happened. Can you give me a minute or do you need to go? Well, I need to go empty this coffee mug, so I will put the phone down and be back in a minute. Excellent, thanks. That minute was all I needed to make sure I had unlimited and returning access to his computer. He came back. Back. Well, Chuck, I'm really embarrassed, but I don't know what happened. I don't want to hold you up, so why don't you go and I will email this to you when I make you another PDF. We can touch base on Monday. Okay, no problem. Have a great weekend. You too, Chuck. We parted ways, and to my surprise and extreme joy, his computer remained on and active. Yes, he kept everything in a secure drive that only he had access to, but in Word documents. I promptly downloaded those Word documents, and within a few hours, I had access to the servers and printed out all of the internal processes he wanted to protect. We did touch base on Monday morning. Not as Tony the fundraiser, but as his security consultants with printouts of his secrets, his passwords, and recordings of the phone calls that were made of him and his staff. This first meeting after a successful attack is always filled with the client's initial shocks and claims that we used unfair tactics and personal weaknesses to gain access. When we explain that the bad guys will use the exact same tactics, the look of anger turns to fear, and that fear turns to understanding. Applying the SE framework to the overconfident CEO hack. As in the previous examples, applying the case to the social engineering framework and seeing what was good and what could have been improved upon can be beneficial. As always, information gathering is the key to any social engineering effort, and this particular story shows it. Information gathering from many sources, the web, Multego, the phone, and more, is what made this attack successful. Insufficient information would have led to a miserable failure. Proper and plentiful information makes all the difference. Even information I never needed, like his church and his parents' and siblings' names. These things were useful to have in case I needed them, but what proved to be invaluable was the information about the email naming convention and the files on the servers using Multego. This was the pathway to getting my foot in the door of this company. Keeping the information you find cataloged into Basket or Dratis, as discussed in Chapter 2, and ready to use is also important. Otherwise, you just have a text file with a jumble of information you can't make use of. Organizing the information is just as important as gathering and using it. Thinking like a bad guy, that is, looking for ways to exploit the weaknesses and desires of the target, isn't a great part of the job. But if a professional auditor wants to protect clients, he will show them how vulnerable they are. The more information you gather, the easier finding vulnerabilities becomes. You begin to see pathways that can lead to success. Developing realistic pretexts and themes that will have the maximum effect also contributes to an attack success. One must develop power questions and keywords to use that will attract the target. By gathering a lot of information, I was able to develop good questions and a frame that involved keywords and neurolinguistic power words, which I then used in influence tactics that I was fairly sure would work. My pretext had to change often, from calling the company's vendors to calling internal employees for information. I had to plan out each pretext, get into that character, and successfully follow through. This, of course, took a lot of planning to make sure each pretext sounded right, flowed properly, and made sense. Practice makes perfect. Before the attack was launched, my partner and I practiced everything. I had to make sure the PDFs worked and that the vector made sense. I also had to have good enough knowledge to be believable to whatever target I was speaking to at the time. The importance of practicing cannot be understated. Practice enabled me to figure out what tactics would work and what wouldn't, as well as ensure that I could stick to the plan and go with the flow, even if that flow was in a direction in which I wasn't planning on going. In hindsight, I discovered a couple small improvements that would have made this attack more efficient. For one, it is always a risk to rely solely on a malicious PDF. I should have set up a small website that mimicked the real cancer research website and had the PDF on there. Both the website and the PDF could have been malicious. This would have doubled my chances of success and given me backup in case one avenue failed. Another large risk I took was that the CEO would leave his computer on when he left the office. If he did not, I would have had to wait till Monday to try to gain access. To keep him at his computer, I should have had a real PDF with information in it he could read that I would send after the malicious PDF worked in exploiting his machine. This would have kept him working at his machine long enough to make good use of the exploit. This audit took about a week's worth of time to investigate, gather, and organize information for. Practice, and then launch. 1 week and his company's secrets could have been owned by his competitors or the highest bidder. Had Nagy Case Study 2, The Theme Park Scandal. The theme park scandal case was interesting to me because it involved some on-site testing. I used many of the social engineering skills mentioned throughout this book and thoroughly tested them during this case. It was also interesting because the nature of the business and the potential for successful scam. If successful, the social engineer could potentially have access to thousands of credit card numbers. The target. The target was a theme park that was concerned about having one of its ticketing systems compromised. Where patrons checked in, each computer contained a link to the servers, client information, and financial records. The park wanted to see whether the possibility existed for an attacker to use malicious methods to get an employee to take an action that could lead to a compromise. The goal wasn't to get an employee in trouble, but rather to see what damage would result from an employee check-in computer being compromised. In addition, the goal was not to compromise the computers through hacking, but through purely social engineering efforts. If such a compromise could occur, what were the ramifications? What data could be found? And what servers could be compromised? They didn't want to go deep, just really find out whether the first stage, a social engineering compromise, could work. To figure out whether a successful SE attack was possible, I had to understand the theme park's processes and methods for checking in customers and what the employees would and wouldn't do at their terminals. Or more importantly, could or couldn't do. The story. As mentioned earlier, the goal of this particular job wasn't really complex. I just had to find out whether the person behind the counter would allow a customer to get the employee to do something obviously not allowed. Before I could even think of what that was, I had to understand their business. I browsed the park's website and used MaltEgo and Google to research articles and other information about the organization. I also did some on-site research. I then went to the park and went through the process of buying a ticket at the ticket counter. During this process, I started a small conversation with the teller and spent some time observing the layout, their computer nodes, and other aspects of the office area. This area was where I started to see a clear picture. During the conversation, I mentioned I was from a small town with a huge name. When she asked where, I told her and she issued the normal response. Where the heck is that? Do you have internet access here? Yeah, I do. Oh, you'll love this. Go to maps.google.com and type in the zip code 11111 and put it in the satellite view. Look how small that town is. Oh my gosh, that is tiny. I don't think I've ever heard of this place before today. In this short amount of time, I knew the following. The layout of the space a teller has to work in. How employees check in each patron. That the computers have full web access. I went back to the park's website and started browsing with a new enlightenment on their processes. I needed a way in to their computer systems. My pretext was a reasonable one. I was a father who was going to take his family to the theme park for the day. My story was that the family and I didn't have plans to do it, but we came to the hotel and were browsing the web for things to do and saw a great discount for the park. We went down to the lobby and inquired about getting tickets, but the price we were given there was substantially more than what we saw on the web. When we double-checked the price we had found, we discovered it was a web-only price. We paid, then realized the tickets needed to be printed so they can be scanned. I tried to get the hotel to print them, but the printer was down. I had already paid and was nervous about losing the tickets, so I printed them to a PDF, then emailed them to myself. Sounds like a reasonable story, doesn't it? One more step was needed before I could launch my evil plot. I had to make a quick phone call. Hello, is this XYZ Theme Park main office? Sure is, can I help you? I needed to get an internal office person to ask my question and make sure I had the right answer. After requesting the purchasing department, I was directed to the right person. I said, Hi, my name is Paul from Securisoft. We are giving away a free trial of a new software to read and even print PDFs. I would like to send you a URL for the free download. Is that okay? Well, I'm not sure we are interested, but you can send me some information. Okay, excellent. Can I ask what version of Adobe you use now? I think we are still on 8. Okay, I will send you out a comparative information packet today. Armed with the version information, all I needed to do was create a malicious PDF embedded with a reverse shell, which would give me access to their computer once they opened the PDF. Call it receipt.pdf and then email it to myself. The next day, I roped my family into a little social engineering action. As they stood off in the distance, I approached the woman behind the counter and started a friendly conversation. "Hi there, how are you? Tina?" I said, reading her name tag. "Doing okay, what can I help you with?" she said with a friendly customer service smile. "See, we decided to take a little weekend